And I think I'm right in saying you're working on a book in this area as we speak.
I'm not just working on a book, it's finished. And it will be...
That's Beth Watts talking with Hazel Easthope about her new book, which is out now with Edward Elgar Publishing.
It's called The Politics and Practices of Apartment Living, and it deals with issues of, amongst other things, control in multi-owned properties.
And we'll hear more from Hazel and Beth a little later in the podcast when Hazel talks about her recent plenary at the Housing Studies Association conference. In this episode, we'll also hear from Dallas Rogers and Peter Matthews.
Presumed narrative of LGBT homelessness is that people who identify as LGBT experience homelessness through family rejection. And actually in this research, we suggest it's much more complex and nuanced than this, and that we really need to focus much more on the agency of homeless people who identify as LGBT and understand the full complexity of their experiences.
Hello and welcome to the Housing Journal podcast, a collaboration between the leading housing journals, the International Journal of Housing Policy, Housing Studies and Housing Theory and Society. I'm Emma Power, editor of the International Journal of Housing Policy. In this episode, we hear more of that interview between Dallas Rogers, editor of the International Journal of Housing Policy, and Peter Matthews, senior lecturer in sociology, social policy and criminology at the University of Stirling. Dallas and Peter sit down and talk about lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and queer experiences of homelessness and identity. We'll also finish up the conversation between Beth Watts from Housing Studies and Hazel Easthope, Associate Professor at the University of New South Wales. They discuss Hazel's recent plenary at the Housing Studies Association conference. Hazel explores the attachments and emotions that make a house into a home and the ways that homemaking is controlled and regulated in different housing contexts. But first, Julie Lawson sits down with Willem Cortels-Alters to discuss his latest paper in Housing Theory and Society.
In Housing Theory and Society's second issue for 2019, Professor Willem Cortels-Alters from OTB at TU Delft considers the difference a country's context makes to the role and impact of global private equity firms. I'm speaking with Willem now about his research which concerns the investment strategies of Annington and Deutsche Annington in the UK and Germany. You stress the importance of relational structures embedded in the UK and German capitalism. Can you explain the difference between capitalist relations of a social market economy and the liberal market model? And what difference do these different models mean for tenants?
Thank you. There's a lot of literature on those differences, but basically it says that the shareholders model is more part of a liberal market economy and the stakeholders model is more of a social market economy. The idea is that in the management of a firm, not only the interests of shareholders play a role, but also of other stakeholders. So in relation to housing companies, the impact, the role of tenants is more important generally, and that has its basic also in laws and regulations, but also in the institutional structure of the housing market.
You've got a really interesting article in Housing Theory and Society, this second issue, and which you take one case of a firm, Annington, which has two incarnations, one in the UK, Annington, and one in Germany, Deutsche Annington. Deutsche Annington's now called Vonovia, I believe. Is that right?
That's right. It's the largest homeowner in Europe.
Wow. So it's entered both these countries' housing markets in a very significant but different way. Can you explain how it's differently impacted those two housing settings?
Now, in the UK example, it were former defence quarters, and it just bought them. If the defence had surplus housing, they could transfer them to Annington, and they mainly did nothing more with it than sell them and make a lot of money based on the value increase of the stock. In Germany, it were originally a railway workers' housing, but they have been working together with how got merged with all kinds of other housing stocks and had this gigantic 300,000 plus housing portfolio now. So they have different trajectories worked into it, and that worked quite differently.
I'd like to focus on the state's role in this so-called shareholder revolution. You zero in on what you call the calculative practices and fiscal settings in each case. Can you explain how humble accounting rules have influenced the investment strategies of these global private equity firms?
Yes, the idea is that those accounting rules reflect, of course, the difference between liberal market economies and social market economies. However, of course, they are going to change as part of the European Union, in which the idea is that there will be one set of accounting rules within the whole Europe. The idea was that in liberal market economies, the value is more attributed based on exit price. What does it? What is the value of an asset if you sell it? And in social market economy, is more the idea of holding the asset has a larger role in it.
So private equity firms use short-term investment strategy to extract value from existing assets. They do not tend to build new assets. In fact, they're more likely to load up these assets with debt, or at least the providers of the assets with debt, with financing costs deducted from any taxable income. This often implies, of course, that they pay very little or even no tax is paid by the firms with multi-billion dollar or euro portfolios. Can you explain how tax affects private equity investment strategies a little more? And is this the same across Europe?
There are differences, of course, in tax systems. And for example, in this UK example, you didn't pay taxes on the value increases of the stock. And the other, the rental incomes and all kinds of incomes were necessary to repay the debt. So formally, the property didn't make any profit. So you didn't pay taxes on profit. In Germany, the tax system is differently, and you pay taxes on this value increases. Although the value increases were more moderate because of the other accountancy rules, they pay taxes on them. So there are different ways of how the tax rules have impact onto it, and it maybe it looks a little bit at the mortgage deductible schemes. If you have a large mortgage in many areas, you get paid less income taxes, and this is more or less the same as it works with those private equity firms. And so those tax rules have impact on, say, the mortgage markets, but they've also impact on the private equity markets.
What about impact on, say, public concerns? In your article, the ethical concerns associated with private equity are quite salient. Should we be concerned? And if so, what should states do to guide investments towards building greater social value rather than merely extracting this value at the public's expense?
It's very good to have good rules and regulations. In Germany, there are generally some kind of infrastructure of tenants' organizations. There are rules about how you may raise rents. And there are also some kind of monitoring checks and balances. And also, governments tend to listen to those tenants' organizations because tenants have over 40% of their voters. So they are very much reliant to listen to that. In the UK, since the Thatcher Revolution, the short hold, so the 6 months contracts after which you have no security of tenants at all, is the primary way to have your tenancy. So if something is wrong, you don't have much rights after 6 months. So that makes a huge difference in the relationship between landlords and tenants.
So thank you very much, Professor Cortels-Altos.
Thank you.
That was Julie Lawson and Willem Cortels-Altes discussing his paper, Annington versus Deutsche Annington, Private Equity and Housing in the Anglo-Saxon and Rhenish Contexts, which is published recently in Housing Theory and Society. Next, we hear from Dallas Rogers and Peter Matthews.
You've been doing some research on LGBT+ people who experience homelessness in Scotland. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, it came out of some earlier work we'd done analysing data in Scotland, where we found out that disproportionate number of non-straight people lived in the most deprived neighbourhoods in Scotland. And this came as a bit of a surprise to us, because deprived neighbourhoods in Scotland aren't trendy gentrifying inner cities, they're peripheral social housing estates. And so we wondered why that was, and we theorised that maybe it was people who experienced exclusion earlier in their lives and that had led to homelessness, and then they were allocated housing in these neighbourhoods and then they'd end up living there. And so this was a follow-on small qualitative research project where basically we set out to find people who had had these sorts of narratives to understand their experiences, and particularly their experiences of accessing homelessness services, to see if what the level of service they got was, and whether that was what was happening, that they were being channeled into this particular housing type through that accessing homeless services.
How many people did you talk to?
So in total, we aimed quite high, but actually in the end, it was very difficult to recruit participants. So only 3% of the population identify as non-heterosexual, so it's a very small number. So in the end, we managed to recruit 20 participants who were both would identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, pansexual, and transgender as well, or gender diverse. And it was interesting, there were two samples, one that was people who experienced homelessness and the other one was people who lived in deprived neighbourhoods. But there was a lot of overlap between the two samples as well. So a lot of the people who we recruited because they lived in deprived neighbourhoods, they'd also experienced homelessness in some way earlier in their lives.
Mm. And one of the kind of key arguments in this paper is not to look at people as necessarily passive victims of homophobic or transphobic ideas or society, but to look at sort of agency in this group of people. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, this was quite a surprise in the finding, because a lot of the research on LGBT homelessness, it uses what's called the families of choice theory, that people experience family rejection because they come out as LGB or T, and then their families kick them out. And we did find some of that, but actually what we most of our participants, the stories were more complex than that. And actually, if you looked at a lot of the characteristics around their background, the chances are they would be the sort of people who experience homelessness anyway. We didn't really find that families of choice story coming out. These people, like, for example, had experienced abuse at home from their parents. So as most homelessness research shows, the chances are they probably end up homeless anyway. And then what was important, what we found, was that their sexual or gender identity was another layering on top of that that added further complexity to that. And quite importantly, through that process of experiencing homelessness, they actually developed their identity quite a lot through that. So I don't want to say it was a positive experience, but it was those two processes of being homeless and developing their identity closely paralleled each other.
Mm. Is there a good example from the case study material that kind of brings that to light?
Yeah, there's one particular participant who was identified as gender non-binary, who chose a pseudonym Ollie, and they talked about they had been in an abusive family relationship. They'd been a victim of psychological abuse from their mother, and they came out as gay initially, and that was okay, but it made the family situation a bit more difficult. And then they came out as trans, and then they were basically kicked out of the family home. And they'd end up sofa surfing, and they had slept rough one night and then accessed supported accommodation, so good quality supported accommodation. And through that accommodation, they got a lot of good support from staff, but importantly, they made friends with other queer people, both in the supported accommodation, but also then developed wider networks out to that wider queer family of choice. And that really helped them establish their identity as this new gender non-binary queer person. And that meant that when they transitioned into a permanent home, that was very strongly linked to, and now I'm happy in who I am, and I'm living in this flat, and I'm comfortable now. So I think that's a really sort of telling narrative, and that's what a lot of our participants experienced.
And another part of the kind of conceptual framework for this article is queer theory itself.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what queer theory is for people who might not know, and how you're bringing that into conversation with other housing theory?
Yeah, so queer theory is an enormous body of work, but essentially where we use it in quite a light touch way, and what we particularly draw on is it highlights heteronormativity in society. So just the very everyday ways in which heterosexuality is recreated and made compulsory through just the way we talk about relationships and just very basic
even the things. Home itself, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And actually in the housing side of the research, the way housing organisations just presume it's a heterosexual family unit you're dealing with. So not being the heterosexual family becomes problematic. So we were drawing on that aspect of queer theory and how queer theory really attunes you to noticing those aspects of where the heteronormativity of society impinges on everyday experiences.
And so what did you find when you applied those ideas to this data?
It was what we more used it for was to queer housing theory more and bring it together with housing theory. Because again, a lot of the work on homelessness, it just presumes that the participants are heterosexual. Or it's not that aspect of the identity isn't talked about. And a housing pathway will be the housing pathway for a heterosexual. So we really brought it in there to say, actually, housing theory really hasn't talked that much about non-heterosexual experiences of home. And so therefore, that's why we need to start bringing in queer theory to shake that up a bit. And the other thing queer theory does is really challenge any categorizations we have, and you chuck those categorizations out the window. So in taking this work further now, I'm exploring kind of, okay, well, what is home and homelessness as a boundary? Why do we have that boundary there? Can we queer that a bit more?
That was Dallas Rogers and Peter Matthews discussing his paper, Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender and Queer Experiences of Homelessness and Identity, published in the International Journal of Housing Policy. The paper was authored with his colleagues Christopher Poyner and Richard Kellgren and is open access on the IJHP website. And now Beth Watts sits down with Hazel Easthope.
So I'm pleased to be here with Hazel Easthope, Associate Professor at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. Hazel has a background in sociology and human geography and is particularly interested in questions about home, mobility and identity and how those interact. She is the Australasian editor for the International Journal Housing Studies and recently gave the opening plenary at the Housing Studies Association conference in Sheffield, the UK. So Hazel, a few weeks ago now, you spoke at the HSA annual conference on the theme, A Place to Call Home. How do you understand the concept of home and what are the key messages you sought to convey in your paper?
So I was talking about houses as homes, and I was talking about homes as places where we develop attachments and where we have strong emotional responses. So when I talk about a house as a home, I'm talking about a place where we can have strong attachments and strong emotional responses. And I was talking about homemaking as a process. So it's not about having a home or not having a home. It's about the process of making a home, of making those attachments and doing that through those emotional connections. So there's different ways that you can make a home through kind of everyday practices and habits, through personalization, like decorating or additions, but also through the relationships that we build in those places. The relationships that we have with our family or friends or housemates, the people who visit us in our homes. And it's also about how we talk about where we live and the kind of often unsaid understandings about what that means about who we are. So home is tied up with identity as well.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the idea of emotions has been neglected in housing studies to date? Or have other people written about that kind of area?
I think in research on home and homemaking, emotions are always implicit and sometimes explicit. Mm-hmm. But I think that it is important that we talk about them explicitly when we're talking about housing in general, because one of the main reasons why housing research and housing policy matter is because providing people with houses that they can make homes is central to their well-being. Mm-hmm. More generally.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do these ideas relate to your previous research and work you're doing at the moment?
So in the presentation that I gave at the conference, I focused in particular on the question of control and how being able to be in control of your housing or having some degree of control over your housing can assist in that homemaking process. So the reason I talked about that is that I keep coming up with these issues around the emotional politics of housing and of home and how that relates to control in all the different research I do, even if that's not what I'm looking for. Mm. So the examples that I gave in the plenary ranged from examples of control within the household, so different control that different members of the household may or may not have mm-hmm. over a house. So a project that I worked on multi-generational households, which actually found that the who owned the property or who was paying the mortgage or who was paying the rent actually had a big impact on the interpersonal relations within that household mm-hmm. and how much control people felt they had and whether they felt that this was their home or not. And so that's kind of at one end of the scale. At the other end of the scale, I also talked about the redevelopment of multi-owned property, so the redevelopment of apartment properties where each apartment's owned by a different owner, and the big challenges to property law that have arisen by changes in laws around the world to allow redevelopment with less than unanimous consent. So essentially what that means is that a supermajority of owners, normally 75 or 80%, can vote the minority out of their homes, essentially. And that's causing all sorts of challenges to notions around property ownership and control and how that's different in different types of property. In between that, obviously the question of tenancy and especially private renters and how much control they have over their tenancies and the impacts that it can have on their lives if they don't have that kind of control.
Mm. Yeah, really fascinating stuff. And actually, in a completely different area of housing studies in my work on homelessness, that theme of control over one's immediate environment has been a really important theme recently, and the idea that in congregate forms of accommodation for homeless households like hostels, the kind of control exacted by the service in terms of rules that people have to abide by or the routines that they have to live by, just in terms of the times of meals or the amount or type of food that people are able to eat, whether they're allowed to have visitors in the accommodation, that kind of thing, how central that control or lack of it is for their well-being. So your paper really resonated.
One of the other examples that I gave in the plenary actually is another one from multi-owned housing, which is around smoking. So there's been a recent court case in Canada, which I find fascinating, where one condominium owner was told by the court that he couldn't smoke in his unit. Because his smoke was permeating into the next door neighbour's unit and the next door neighbour had asthma. Mm-hmm. And in that judgment, the judge said, it's more reasonable for me to tell you that you can't smoke in your unit than to tell your neighbour to go outside to breathe. So, you know, these issues of control and contested control are really important.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And that theme of housing or home as a kind of site of struggle was a key theme of the conference. So, I think the contribution fitted really well with that. What would you say are the key takeaways for people working in housing policy and practice?
I think too often housing policy is made into a numbers game. We need to provide X number of houses for X number of people. Now, it's important to provide houses, and it's important to provide houses that are adequate and meet people's needs. But I think housing is also a game of emotional politics, and that needs to be taken really seriously, that the importance of being able to make a house into a home is central to everything else in a person's life. And a lot of that is tied up with the emotions around homemaking practices.
Mm-hmm. So you're really calling for the role of the state and other key stakeholders, developers, for instance, in taking seriously how people feel within their homes, and that as a kind of legitimate end of public policy, I guess.
Yeah, and also I think that if you can properly understand people's emotions as they relate to their houses as homes, you can actually harness those. So it's not just a question of we want to put in policy X, how are we going to manage around people's emotions to that? Mm-hmm. It's about, we want to deal with this policy issue. The first thing we need to do is to consider what this means for people's control over their housing and how they're likely to emotionally react. And then we need to harness those considerations and emotional reactions in developing that policy. That's the order in which things need to happen. So the emotions become part of what actually drives effective policy.
Yeah. Thanks very much for joining us, Hazel.
Thanks.
That's it from us at the Housing Journal podcast. We're a collaboration of the leading housing journals, the International Journal of Housing Policy, Housing Studies and Housing Theory and Society. You can follow each of the journals on Twitter. The International Journal of Housing Policy tweets at IJHP editors. Housing Studies is at Housing Journal. And you can follow Housing Theory and Society at Housing Theory. To listen to back episodes and subscribe to the Housing Journal podcast, go to ijhp.online/pod. I'm Emma Power. We look forward to catching up with you in our next edition.